go. Hello and welcome to Writer Mother Monster. I'm your host, Lara Ehrlich, and our guest today is Disha Filya. Before I introduce Disha, thank you all for tuning in and please chat with us during the interview. And if you enjoy the episode, also consider becoming a patron or patroness to keep the podcast going. And if you haven't already, please also join me on Saturday for the first Writer Mother Monster workshop. Just in time for Mother's Day. It's called Prioritizing Your Craft for Writer Moms. We'll share strategies for prioritizing our craft, explore examples set by other writer moms, and write. And we'll leave the workshop energized and armed with a plan for recommitting to our creative work. To register, just visit writermothermonster.com and click on classes. Now, I'm excited to introduce Disha. Disha Filya's debut short story collection, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, won the 2021 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, the 2020-2021 Story Prize, and a 2020 LA Times Book Prize Award for Best for First Fiction. The collection was also a finalist for the 2020 National Book Award for Fiction. The Secret Lives of Church Ladies focuses on Black women, sex, and the Black church, and is being adapted for television by HBO Max with Tessa Thompson executive producing. Disha is also the co-author of Co-Parenting 101, Helping Your Kids Thrive in Two Households After Divorce. Her work has been listed as notable in the Best American Essays series, and her writing on race, parenting, gender, and culture has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, McSweeney's, and many other publications. She is the mother of two children, ages 17 and 22, and she describes writer motherhood as intense, complex, and evolving. So now please join me in welcoming Disha. Welcome.
Hey, Laura. How are you?
Hi. Great. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. So tell me first about these three words that you've used to describe writer motherhood.
Well, intense because, you know, I have to own it. I'm intense and my children are intense. So they probably would say they're not intense, but they're intense. So, you know, you've got, you know, three intense women. So, you know, that just sort of colors everything. We have fun, but there is a level of intensity that we all can, you know, bring to situations. Complex, the same thing. Mothering is the hardest thing I've ever done. It, you know, hands down. And I think it's the hardest thing I'll ever do. Because, you know, individually we're complex human beings and we are these systems of needs and desires and quirks. And then you put these systems, you know, in each other's orbit and, you know, trying to figure it out. And then, you know, we're at different stages of our lives, you know, children, they're going through their stages. And then we as moms are going through, you know, I'm going through my own stages. And so there's a lot happening all at once. So that's the complexity. And then the last one was evolving. And so, you know, I don't know if you get this when people ask you like, oh, does it get easier? And I just tell people all the time, it gets different. And that's the evolution of it. It's just always changing.
Yeah.
Different things to worry about, different things to enjoy also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you ask other moms that question when you first became a mother?
Does it get easier?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember asking that. I was really lucky in that I found this group of like really great moms online who were all, you know, their children were older than mine. And I was pregnant and then they all had older kids. And they what connected everybody was they were all homeschoolers because I thought I was going to homeschool at that time. And so I, you know, spent my entire pregnancy, you know, in these conversations with them, these virtual conversations. And so I could see them at the different stages. And I was like, yeah, there's no easy stage. There's no, you know, because I always heard like, what is it, you know, the terrible twos, right? I knew about that. And then they would be talking about like the things that were unique to three. and then 4, and then this thing that happens at 7, and then 10. And I was like, so basically what you're telling me is that it never ends, you know? And then there's parenting an adult, which I'm doing now, and which has its own unique, its own experience. So yeah, I didn't ask that specific question, but I've always been watching other mothers.
Yeah. Did you always know you wanted to be a mother?
Yes, that was always part of the plan.
Yeah. I didn't. I thought I would never want to be a mother, so it took me by surprise when I realized that was something I should be. So tell me a little bit more about having always wanted to be a mother. Like, why did you feel that desire?
I think, I mean, for the same reason that I thought you get married, you go to college, it was just the things that you do, and it's what makes your, I thought, it's what makes your life complete. And I grew up, I was raised by my mother and my grandmother. My mother was a single mom. I watched a lot of television as a kid, and I sort of bought into the notion of, you know, a normal family is a nuclear family. And I didn't, you know, and I had some shame around the fact that I didn't have that kind of family. And so I always wanted to recreate that and have that nuclear family with me then as the mom. So that was always in the plan.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about growing up. What was your own mother like?
My mother was intense. You know, again, if, you know, she's since passed away, but I think if she heard me say that, she'd say, I'm not intense. She's totally intense. And she was absolutely devoted to me, and I wanted for nothing. I knew every second of my life with her that I was loved. But it was suffocating at a certain point. There's some bits and pieces of my mother and me in my collection of stories. And there's a line where the one character in Snowfall is describing her mother's love as like a blanket. It's like, you know, in summer, it's like, it's suffocating. But then when you need it, you miss it, you know, and that's kind of how it was with my mom. She could be a little too much. She was also very critical, and that really shaped me in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of unlearning and healing I had to do. So it was this sort of complexity of absolutely loving and devoted, but, you know, she, you know, would have nitpicked me to death if I had not eventually, you know, created some boundaries with her.
Yeah. How did that relationship kind of set up your expectations for motherhood?
Well, you know, a lot of people, it's like, well, I'm never going to do that, you know, or I'm never going to say that. I'm not going to be, you know, and I think it gave me a false sense of my power as a mother, and how mother, like, kids are not widgets. Like, you know, you can't just put in these inputs and then there's this output that's guaranteed, you know? And so there's no guarantee that, okay, here's this list of things that my mother did that I, you know, wish she hadn't. And here's this list of things she did that were wonderful. And so I'm going to, you know, do all the wonderful things. I'm not going to do the horrible things. And it's, you know, and you still have challenges. There's still things that I did that, you know, my kids wish I wouldn't have done, or the things that they wanted me to do that I didn't do. And so there's no perfect, you know, mothering that's going to happen just by not doing the things that your mother did wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it gave me a blueprint, because there are some things that I did right. And I think it's important for us to remember as mothers as well. Like, it's very easy to focus on where we drop the ball as parents, but to think about the things we did right. And so, you know, my mother's being devoted to me and, you know, treating me like a person, you know, that my needs were important. And that I, you know, I felt loved, you know, my mother was demonstrative, things that I took for granted. But you know, that was easy for me in parenting my own kids. You know, hugging and, you know, being, tender with your children. You know, I got that from my mother and did that in my own mothering. I also, you know, kind of the inverse was true, which was, you know, really listening to them. And this has been really hard. I thought it would be easy because I wanted my mother seemed to chafe against the fact that I was a separate person. And that my doing things differently, she took it as a like a criticism of her and how she did things. So I just thought, you know, whatever my kids do, you know, as long as it's not harmful, you know, I'm not going to have anything to say. I want them to be their own person. And now I'm like, oh, you know, I see now that desire to want them to do things a certain way, but it's like picking my battles. You know, my mother never picked her battle. Everything was a battle with her. And so I'm learning to say less. And my kids would probably say, really? Because you say a lot, you know, but they have no idea how much I, you know, keep things to myself when I want to say something. So I'm trying not to nitpick.
Well, especially as they are getting older and 17 and 22, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I imagine that those are the ages at which, and I don't know because my daughter is 5, but those are the ages at which they're starting to maybe make choices that you really would like to nitpick them.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And then also just letting them learn, you know, as we say, learn things the hard way.
Yeah.
You know, having, you know, they have to make mistakes. That's the hardest thing, is to watch them make mistakes, watch them do things that, you know, I'm like, I know how that ends, you know, but I have to step back and not always, you know, there's a time and place to speak and say, you know, I've been there, or here's some perspective I have because I'm older. I'm going to give it to you. You do with it what you will, as opposed to, you know, like putting down the hammer, you know, which at a certain point you just can't, you know.
Yeah.
You can tell them what you know. You can make suggestions, but they're their own people.
Yeah, and they're born as their own people, aren't they? Mm-hmm. They just come right out and they're their own personalities. Yeah. How did you, well, let's see, where do I want to start with this question? I'll just jump right in. How did having children change you as a writer?
It was all kind of a line. Hang on one second. I'm going to see this light. Is that okay? Yeah, I feel like I'm less shiny now.
Yeah. No,
you know, I started writing when my oldest daughter was 2, and she did nap. So I've been a writer. I've been a mother longer than I've been a writer, by a couple of years. And it started really incrementally. Writing was something that, I did as an escape and also as a solace for myself, because I was a stay at home mom and, you know, 24/7 was taking care of my daughter. And then I carved out that little bit of time each day, and then it started to expand over time. And so, you know, one thing that being a mother taught me there was that this time is precious, you know, and so, you know, trying to not waste time and finding writing time, where I can. And then over the years too, thinking about, you know, whose story, you know, having children forces you to think, like, what are your stories to tell and what are not your stories to tell, and where your stories interlap with someone else, be it a parent or a child. How do you negotiate and navigate those lines? You know, I've written about my mother, I've written about my children, and it was always trying to figure out where my story ended and theirs started, and then still getting it wrong sometimes. You know, I wrote about them extensively when they were much younger and when I was early in my writing career, and there are things now that I regret that I wrote about, not specific stories or anything, but just in general, because if we're serious about the concept of consent, they thought it was fun that I wrote about them. But as minors, like, they didn't understand the magnitude of what was happening. And so they couldn't give me consent. And, you know, I could have, you know, if I call myself a writer, and I do, I could have done a better job of figuring out, how do I write about motherhood without doing it in a way that now I feel like kind of violated their privacy.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of other writer mothers on the show talk about that line between your story and how it intersects with children's story, and then what the line is between yours and theirs.
Yeah.
Is that a line? It sounds as though you're saying that line evolves or constantly kind of moves, and you have to figure out where it is.
Yeah. So I'll give you an example. My younger daughter is adopted, and so I wrote extensively about that. I had a whole column at Literary Mama called "The Girl Is Mine," and it was all about being an adoptive mom. And And then when I think she was 12, around 12, she was interested in doing a DNA test. And again, I asked her permission, but, you know, she's 12. And I said, you know, may I write about why you want to do this test? And, you know, and also about me as your mother, knowing that you're trying to find out as much as you can about your biological roots. And so I think I was doing a really good job of respecting that line. And the editor was like, wow, there's just something missing. I was like, yeah, there's a whole person missing. It's my kid. I'm trying to respect that, you know, her, you know, this, I'm trying to tell the part of this that is my story. And, but it just wasn't working. And so the editor was saying, you know, maybe talking to her about certain things. And then I was like, you know what, let's do this. And I reached out to her and I said, you know, this is what I'm writing. This is what's happening. Would you be interested in writing this with me? And so then it became an alternating narrative and we did it that way.
Wow. Tell me a little bit about writing with your daughter. Like, was that the first time you'd done that?
Yeah. Yeah. I just told her, you know, I would send her a paragraph and ask her to write whatever she wanted to say after that. And, you know, write it kind of in response to what I was had written. Or if I would say, you know, well, I'm wondering about whatever. And then she would respond in her paragraph and then I'd write something else. And it was wonderful because I could relax a little bit and feel less like I was, I don't know, cannibalizing is too strong, but just, you know, it felt like it felt more right. And it was a better story, of course.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear you say that there's something missing and then to kind of problem solve how to address what that was in a creative way also, just from a craft perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a comment from Danielle Borsico. Hi, Danielle. She says, it's interesting to hear your thoughts on permission. She thinks parents have an innate feeling of ownership of their children that sometimes never evolves. I wonder, what do you think about that?
You know, that's a benefit of my mother parenting me the way she did. I chafed against that. My mother definitely felt like not only that, not so much that she owned me, but like we were the same person or I was just an extension of her. And I hated all of that and everything about it. And that was one of those, I'm never going to, you know, treat my children as just an extension of myself. I don't own them. They are their own person. And not only do I need to do that just for a healthy set of boundaries and relationship with them, but that's how I want them to engage the rest of the world. I want them to feel like they belong to themselves and that they have agency, and we don't want other people, our children, to feel beholden to other people. So we can model that in the beginning by letting them know, you're not even beholden to me, you know, as your parent, like, you know, you belong to yourself.
Yeah. I think that's such an important lesson to learn, especially I would think for young women.
Yes, especially.
Yeah. Let's go back for a second to your fledgling writing career, because as we saw in your bio at the beginning, this has been quite a year for you. You've won literally probably every award for for a debut book and the top prizes for short story collections. And so tell me a little bit about the beginning of writing when your child was two. So this was like literally when you came to writing, or had you written anything before that point?
No, I mean, I, you know, had to write in school and I enjoyed it, but I never thought about writing as a career. It didn't seem practical. But it, I was drawn to it as a form of escape, and it, you know, it felt good to write, and it was something that I could just do for myself. And so I was initially writing fiction, and I was writing, I didn't think about the characters as church ladies, even though they were, because I was really mining my memories and my nostalgia of growing up in the South and being in church a lot. And those women just really loomed large for me, but I didn't think of them as church ladies. What I was, they were just dissatisfied women. And so my, I was dissatisfied in my own life. But I wasn't comfortable writing nonfiction, so I gave that dissatisfaction to these characters. And then, so I tried my hand at novel writing, and a couple of novels just kind of crashed and burned. And then the third one really had legs, and I started that one in 2007. And I got about 2/3 of the way done with that. And it also stalled. And now I know it stalled because I really lost interest in the character as I had written her. There were really no high stakes and I wasn't interested in her problems or what she wanted or any. But I kept trying to write it without that awareness. It took finishing my collection to realize, oh, I don't care about that stuff anymore. You know, I kept trying to write a novel, you know, a decade later, you know, that I had started a decade earlier. And so, you know, I started changing the character a little bit over the years, but I had changed so much so that what was interesting to me in 2007 certainly wasn't interesting to me a decade later. So once I finished this collection, you know, I understood what was going on with that novel, but the novel was stalling. I started writing these short stories and I had an agent for the co-parenting book who was, you know, ready to see a novel. She was like, we can do this. And so she'd also heard me read some of these short stories. And so when she saw that I was not making any headway and with the novel after hitting that wall, she said, you know, I like these church lady stories. Maybe you could get intentional about that and build a collection of stories around these themes, Black women, sex, and the Black church. And I was like, that sounds doable. I can do that. And she even broke it down further. And she said, you know, if you can write three stories, get them published, we'll have a partial manuscript. She said, I can pitch this and shop this around as a partial manuscript. That felt more doable than finish that novel that you started, you know, all those years ago. And so that's how the collection came to be. And that's kind of the arc of my fiction life. But I had so many detours because I had to make a living. And it's, you know, I could make a living writing and editing. I could write nonfiction. I could write personal essays. I was getting published to do that sort of thing. Writing for public, for nonprofits and companies and doing work that wasn't creative. That's how I paid the bills. And fiction was always like, I'm going to get back to it. I'm going to get back to it. And it was, you know, when I could steal time. And then in 2016, I took a corporate job. And so that gave me the financial stability and freed up more time actually for me to write fiction. And that's when I finished the collection. I was actually working for a big company at that time. And then I left in 2019 and I'm back to just writing.
Yeah, that's, I think, an amazing arc and one that, at least gives me, it makes me feel hopeful, and hopefully a lot of women who are listening right now feel hopeful that, that, you know, just because you abandon a novel doesn't mean that you're not a writer, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And if you have a corporate job or a job that's not in writing, that doesn't mean that you're not a writer. In fact, it can help you become a writer or to dedicate yourself more to your writing.
Yeah. When you're not worried about how you're going to pay your bills, it frees your mind up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the craft side and how you developed your craft. So once you started writing and your daughter was two, what did you do to, you know, you're like, okay, I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to be serious. What did you do?
So I did a couple of things. The first was really dorky, which was I wrote to writers. Like if I read a book and I liked it, I figured out how to write to that writer. And then just send them like the dorkiest fan mail and just ask really general questions like, I want to be a writer. Do you have any advice for me? You know, and people would write back, which is great. You know, it was really nice of them because, again, very dorky. But I learned a lot, you know, by asking that question. And then I also read a lot of books on craft, and I never went back to for an MFA. I have a bachelor's in economics and I have a master's in teaching. I'm not a I've just never felt like going back to school for a degree. So I would take classes everywhere classes were offered, conferences and retreats and all of that, workshops everywhere. But Literary Mama was definitely a big part of my writing education because the column that I wrote there, I wrote it for 4 years. And it was, I think it was every month or every other month, but we were all edited by two editors, which was a fantastic education. And then there was about a dozen columnists and we would edit each other as we had time. And so the experience of editing other people's work, I learned a lot that way. So that was really helpful as well. And then just finding writing community, finding writing buddies, people who could be my readers. You know, you need your champions, people. It's like your mom putting your stuff on the refrigerator, people who are going to just like cheer you on no matter what. But in addition to those people, and sometimes it's the same people, but not always, you need readers who love you enough to tell you the truth and not just, you know, blow smoke up your ass, but like to tell you when something isn't great and how you can make it great, or if it's good, how you can make it great. You know, and people who have the skill to give you that kind of feedback. And so I started building that network and building those relationships.
Yeah. No. And tell me a little bit about, so you said you went to conferences and took mm-hmm. workshops and things.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the logistics of the yeah. time. Where mm-hmm. did you steal the time from to do that while you had children?
You know, the funny thing about divorce, and you know, I've had this experience and I've heard it from other women, that it's sad, but sometimes you get more time once you get divorced because you have a set schedule of this is when they're going to be with their other parent and you can plan things, as opposed to what happens for a lot of us when you're under the same roof, you are just the default parent, always on call, or on duty. And, you know, shout out to my co-parent, you know, he's always been a hands-on father. And so that was never, an issue for us. If anything, with me, it was, being able to pull myself away, you know, and that took time. Over time, I started being able to do that. But a lot of times I had to leave the house to do it. But once we split up, it was, you know, I knew which days I didn't have my kids. I knew which weekends I didn't have my kids. And then I could, you know, actually be present with my writing the same way when my kids were with me, I could be present with them. But I know that, that's not always the case, for mothers, that either we don't have a partner that prioritizes us getting a break and using that break however we want, or, you know, we have to own it. Sometimes we don't trust, like we treat the other parent like a secondary parent as opposed to like our peer. Like they're just as capable. They're just as, you know, good at, you know, they may not do things the way we would do them, but we have to let them, one, because that's their kids too, but two, that's how we get a break, you know? So sometimes it's that part of it, just not being willing to let go. But I did it, and then we got divorced, and you know, and then I was able to have like a regular schedule, and then I didn't have to have the discipline. It was just built in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The difficulty in taking yourself in taking that time for yourself mm-hmm. really speaks to me. That my husband is willing to give me that time, and mm-hmm. I have trouble taking it. I have trouble just kind of saying, yeah. okay, I'm going upstairs to my desk. I'm going to close the door yeah. right now. I hear that from a lot of women, and I've heard likewise from many of the guests who are divorced mm-hmm. that they found the same thing, that mm-hmm. that sort of freed them up in many ways.
Yeah. To work. What is that quote from Carl Jung? It's like something, you know, like the worst thing for a child is the unrealized dream of the parent. I'm not going to get this right until I Google it, but basically, you know, Jung was saying that we think the worst thing is like they're going to feel abandoned or they're going to feel unloved if we're not there. But the worst thing for them is if we're not there for ourselves, you know, if we're not showing up for ourselves and the things that we want to do and the things that we're passionate about, is, you know, to have unrealized dreams as a mother. And I think he specifically said mother, but you know, again, Google it, the unrealized dreams, that affects the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Have your daughters talked at all about you as a writer, like, and, the example that you've set for them in following your creative pursuits?
No, I don't think we're there yet with them being that meta about it, you know, but I know that they're proud of me. I know they're really happy for me. My oldest, I don't know if she's finished the book, but, you know, every now and then she'll text me and she's like, I really like this part, or I really, you know, and that makes me feel really good. And, you know, my youngest hates when I say this, but, you know, she, like, the awards and things were happening, but the loudest she's ever screamed was when she realized that Tessa Thompson started following me on Instagram. She's been monitoring our accounts, Tessa's account and my account. And when she saw that, she just, you know, that was exciting, you know, not the awards or anything like that, but Tessa Thompson. And then when I said that, she was like, no, that's not true. You know, I was excited before. So in fairness, I will tell both sides of it, but yeah, they, you know, they've been celebrating with me, and I want to believe that it matters to them, because I'm always also encouraging them to do whatever they want. You know, I'm the parent that's like, I think you should take a gap year. And they're like, I don't want to take a gap year. I'm like, no, really, take a gap year. So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, and it has been, you're saying that they were celebrated with you this year, and you've had a lot to celebrate. So tell me a little bit just about what this year's been like. We were talking before the interview started about how exciting it's been, but also in the midst of a global pandemic. So it's like two sides of a
coin. Yeah. I mean, and celebrating, but also knowing that more than one thing can be true at a time, you know, that there's a lot of things that I've celebrated. And then there's times when I'm just feeling really down because I'm isolated. You know, I spend half the time in the pandemic by myself, except for my dog, because, you know, my kids are with their dad part of the time. And so that's been really difficult. And the awards are wonderful, and it's validating, especially after, you know, so many years. And it was, you know, people tell you short story collections don't sell. I'm on a university press. It's a debut, all of those things. So a wonderful surprise. It's very, the opportunities that have come from it, you know, having it adapted, but also having this larger platform and being able to then support other writers in ways that I would not have been before, you know, all of that's wonderful. And then at the end of the day, it's like, and there's a deadly pandemic happening and I'm sitting in my house by myself, you know, like that's still hard. That's still lonely. And, and so, you know, I had to show myself that grace and say, yes, both things can be true. You know, I'm completely honored and grateful. And today was really hard, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And you're working on a novel now, you were saying before the interview. Can you tell us anything about the novel?
There's a church lady in it. there's some things that are going to change, you know, certainly have changed since I started in 2007. But what is the same is the main character is the wife of a megachurch pastor, and in the Black church, the pastor's wife is referred to as the first lady. And so she's the first lady of a church, and she's dissatisfied in her marriage and in sort of, you know, her station in life. That thread is the same, and I'm looking to do some different things than I started in 2007. I'm also looking to make it a satirical novel. It was a little too on the nose for me as I was writing it. And there's just a lot of funny stuff that was in the original draft. And then it felt everything else that wasn't funny felt navel gazing. And I'm like, I got a solution for that. Satire.
So this is the same novel that you started in 2007, but completely
basic premise. Okay. But basic main character, but she herself is different. Like, I realized that one of the challenges I have as a writer that I'm constantly working on is raising the stakes. Like when you and I logged on earlier, I was like, I just had this huge epiphany about this novel. And it was like I ratcheted up the stakes for her in a way that I hadn't before with the scandal that she gets involved with. And you know how something with your head, but you don't always apply it. And like, there's something in writing called murder your darlings, you know, like don't be precious with your character. You have to have bad things happen to them. They have to be people who aren't us, who do things that maybe we wouldn't do. And I thought I had done that. I thought I had done a pretty good job with that, but I was coddling her into oblivion, coddling her into boredom. Like I didn't care. I coddled her so much. I didn't care about her because she was just boring, you know? Yeah. And so I had to give her some edges, you know, I had to give her some prickly parts. And so now that she's a little more prickly, now there can be more at stake. And now I think it's juicier than it was before.
I can't wait to read this. Let's talk about dissatisfaction. I'm also interested in dissatisfaction, as I think probably many writer mothers are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just tell me about how it's, tell me about this dissatisfaction in 2007. And you said still kind of the through line for the novel now. So how has that changed?
Well, and let's say dissatisfaction, I started writing in 2000, you know, so this is 20 plus years. I think it's, you know, it's dissatisfaction based on not being content with what we're told we're supposed to be content with. Also, not being content having done everything right, you know? And then it's like, okay, I did all of that and now I'm miserable, you know? But you're supposed to be satisfied, you know, with the, you know, for those of us who are married or were married heterosexually, like you found a good man, you've had these children, you know, if you're financially stable, the world tells you that should be enough. Like certainly you're happy. And so the first incarnation of the novel, the pastor's wife had that exact thing. She was married to a good man. She had a nice house. They had a nice life. And I, I've been married twice. And so one of my in-laws from the second marriage was reading this synopsis that I'd written of the book as it was then. And she was someone who was single into her late 40s and had not been partnered. And so she said, well, that seems really like an interesting story, but can you make sure to explain why she's so happy? Because I don't get it. Or why she's so unhappy? Because she has everything. And it's like, but what if she doesn't love him or she doesn't feel loved by him? Like I had mentioned, it was kind of like a loveless marriage and he was really married to the church and not to her and these things. And all this person could see was she's got a husband, nice house, good standing in the community. Why is she miserable? You know, and I think that rings true for a lot of us.
Yeah. That if you have all the right ingredients, that will make you happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think about that a lot too, and about a restlessness underneath that, and what is it that we want? And I'm sure it's different for everybody, right? But
yeah,
what was it that you wanted?
Oh, and sorry. This idea that we even have wants, you know, because how we're raised to take care of everybody else's needs and wants, and we're not raised to take care of ourselves first. Or sometimes at all, that, you know, we exist to serve that whole, you know, there's like a continuum, you know, but for many of us, you know, the range is really small in terms of, what we should aspire to, you know, but this like personal satisfaction, you know, low on the totem pole, sexual satisfaction, low on the totem pole, you know, that's not how we're conditioned. And so then even when we do small things for ourselves, like take time out to write, you'll hear women say, oh, I feel like I'm being selfish. And it's like taking care of yourself isn't selfish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And now there's the whole culture of self-care too, right?
That
it becomes something sort of like a luxury just to do basic things like take a shower.
Yeah.
So tell me about your own restlessness and how it's changed and how it's come out in your writing.
Yeah, I mean, so I my first marriage, we met in college and our first date was my 18th birthday. And so that's how long we had been together. And then we, you know, got married a year after college. So I married really young. And, you know, and certainly there are people who marry young and it works out for them. But for myself, I didn't know who I was, you know, and so how do you commit to spend a lifetime with someone when you're still in process and so are they? And that's, you know, that was the difficult part, is like trying to figure out who I was and who I wanted to be. And that was evolving. And, And then also looking at, you know, the reasons for getting married, like what they represented for me. There was that normal. There was that, you know, I broke the cycle of women in my family who didn't marry. So marriage was like winning the lottery. And so, you know, why did I have to marry when I was 22? I didn't, you know, why not wait? But it was this idea that like I had gotten the brass ring. So you grab it and you hold on to it and you don't let it go, as opposed to you got a whole life to lead. Like you could date this person, you could live with them, you know, but you don't necessarily have to make this huge commitment at 22 years old when you don't know who you are. And so those kinds of growing pains start to show up. And that's what happened for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Where you grew up and when you grew up, were your peers also getting married pretty much out of high school? And
let's see. One of my friends did, a couple of my friends did, you know, married young. And now that I think about it, I don't think any of our marriages lasted. In college, no, you know, that my friends in college typically married later. But yeah, I mean, I think where I was growing up, the idea of having someone commit to you, as a woman, having a man commit to you, it's like, oh, you know, now everything will be fine, you know? But there was not enough conversation about the quality of the relationship or why marriage was not like traveling and seeing the world or writing a book or something like that, but like marriage was presented as an accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you feel about it now?
If people who are happy being married, and I'm happy for them. But personally, I am looking at the marriage as an institution, and I'm like, I don't see the point, because you can have a huge commitment, and we've seen, you know, queer folks did this forever, who have huge commitments without the legal, you know, stamp of approval. So it's clear that you don't need marriage to have a commitment. And we also know from those of us who get divorced, and also and people who have bad marriages, having marriage doesn't guarantee a good relationship. So, you know, why? That's always my thing is why. And there's a young person in my life, not my child, who is 19, and she was telling me she wanted to get married. And I was like, absolutely not. And so I started doing the whole, tell me why. Because of this. And I was like, you don't have to get married for that. You don't have to get married for that. You can have that and still not get married. What does marriage give you that you can't still have without it? There's certain legal protections. Okay. Other than that, though, you know, but don't think that marriage guarantees fidelity or compatibility or good sex or any of that kind of stuff. So, so I'm not anti-marriage, but I am like, I question marriage, I guess. But, you know, for people who I'm happy for people who are happily married. I love that. You know,
yeah,
I love it when people find their person.
No, it's funny. I mean, I'm happily married, and my husband listens to the podcast sometimes, so I should be careful what I say. But I'm not sure I would get married again, honestly. Like you said, it's so much more a legal thing than anything else. And I think, as you're saying, you can have a partnership that lasts a very good long time, and it doesn't need to be legally bound. So I'm with you there. Right. I agree. So tell me a little bit more about, let's go back to the writing and motherhood side. What did you learn craft-wise from this novel, from revisiting it after having written a collection of short stories? So what did writing short stories teach you about writing a novel?
Well, it taught me that I can write fast. I thought I was somebody like, oh, every story has to take a year or two to finish. Like, no, it does not. That I can actually write fast. It also taught me the importance of experimentation and pivoting and flipping things, and not just, you know, because when I got stuck with the novel, it was, oh, I don't know how to move forward. When I got stuck with stories, it was, well, I'll move on to something else, or I'm going to try it this way, or what if? And that's a you know, if you're someone who likes a lot of certainty, which I used to be, I think I still kind of am, that was difficult, you know, to take that approach. But I had a deadline to meet, and it was like, I gotta finish these stories. But also I had fun, you know, I was starting to have fun doing it. And so I'm, you know, trying to bring that same sense of what if and fun and play and experimentation to writing. I've never been an outliner, and that requires a degree of trust, that you trust that without any kind of outline, if you just write and tell yourself the story as you're going along, these gems will emerge. And it happens, but then I think sometimes, like, you forget it happens until you do it again. And, you know, and so having the book, having the short story collection, the stories, you know, turned out well, it's like, okay, I know now that I can write 20 pages and I might just get two paragraphs, and that's a good thing. It's not time wasted or anything like that. That is literally what drafting is. And so I think in that way, it's like I have more confidence now that, that things will work out, and that, you know, I will discover things, that, and seeing writing as a process of discovery. You know, there's a quote about, you know, you're writing to find meaning. It's not necessarily writing to tell people, like, here's what happened, but you're right. The process of writing, you're finding meaning for yourself in what happened, whether that story is a real story or a made up story. And so just delighting in the process, and having a different perspective on urgency, right? I have a sense of urgency around writing because I feel, you know, very much like this, especially with the pandemic, like we are so mortal, you know, that we don't have forever. But instead of that kind of doom and gloom urgency, this urgency of like, I want to, you know, tell this story. I want to see what happens next, you know? So I have, you know, gotten to a place where I feel more confident and playful as a writer as a result. And I think that's going to make this novel, first, I'll be able to finish it, and then it'll be better than it would have been before.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm interested. I'm really always interested in how short story writers, you know, mm-hmm. switch to novels and vice versa. Yeah. I started with a novel, too, and it was a laborious process of like a 5-year process. Mm-hmm. And it didn't end up selling. And, you know, that's fine. But pivoting to short stories felt, mm-hmm. like you're saying, sort of freeing. And there's a sense that if something's not working, you can turn it on its head because mm-hmm. it is only a short. It's like you can wrap your brain around it, you know, and mm-hmm. It is hard to have that same sense of playfulness, at least when you're a beginning writer and you're trying to like write this important epic or whatever it is that they're working on. So. Yeah. Yeah,
and in the beginning too, I don't know that many of us actually believe in drafting. Like we say we do, but we're still editing as we go along, and that will always hinder, you know? And so that's another thing. I'm finally at a place where like, I will write a shitty first draft, as Anne Lamott said, and then go back in and revise and polish it up. Like I can do that now. I know, I get it now.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Church Ladies, and then I would love for you to read a little bit from it.
Sure.
But tell me about the stories and putting the collection together. I'm finding people are always interested in how you select the stories and the process, whether it's organic or whether you set out to write a collection, and you told us a little bit about that, about your agent pushing you there, which was great.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit about the process of completing the collection and thinking through the stories that would come together as part of Church Ladies.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, my agent said, you know, if I can get 3 stories published, that would be the basis for a manuscript. So by the time I had the 3rd story published, I actually had 6 stories written. One of the stories is called Peach Cobbler. And I like to share that that was one that was not published. And yet now it is the story, when people have a favorite story, 9 times out of 10, it's peach cobbler. When they tell me their favorite story, it's peach cobbler. And that just shows that, like, you know, publishing and editing and rejection, it's all very subjective, you know? And so there were these 6 stories. That was the partial manuscript. And it sold with those 6 stories. And then I had a word count that I had to build to from that. And so then I decided that one of the stories was just kind of like the weakest link. I didn't care for it. And I also didn't, as it was written, and I also didn't feel like I was so interested in it that I wanted to go and fix it and revise. I just wasn't interested. So I was like, I'll just pull it out. And that gives me even more words to fill. And so then I had about 2 dozen or so pieces of stories, everywhere from a sentence long to 20 pages long and everything in between. And so I looked at those, and then I kind of picked maybe 10 or 12, and I wrote a 1-sentence synopsis of each one, and I gave it to 5 or 6 friends, some of whom are my regular readers, but there were some who were not my regular readers, but just people who have, I like their perspective on things. And so I wanted to have this kind of range of people and see, like, when you read these synopses, which ones would you want to read the whole story? And so very quickly, 5 or 6 of the stories, you know, rose to the top, that everybody kind of had these on their list. So I was like, you know what? That's it. These are the stories I'm going to start writing, and I'm going to write until I get to this word count. And then that's how I'm going to finish the collection. So, I was, you know, I picked the, I was working through those, I guess 5 or 6, and it ended up being 4 stories that got me to, the word count. And then in terms of ordering the stories, I felt that Eula, which is first, should be first because it was the first story I had published. So it was a little sentimental, but it's also, one of the most provocative, explicit stories in the collection. And it's, and so I wanted to, you know, open with a bang, no pun. I also want, it also touches on all the themes that show up in the other stories. So I thought, what a wonderful introduction. People can decide right away, like, do I really want to, you know, read this or not? And then I wanted to mix up the stories so that you didn't have really long stories back to back. And then I didn't have, real heavy stories back to back. So Dear Sister is, I think, the funniest story in the collection. So, you know, putting that, sandwiching that between 2 heavier stories. And then the end, I knew that I wanted to end with, I always think of it like a sigh, like whether it's this collection as a whole or individual stories, because a sigh can be satisfaction. It could be resignation. It could be frustration, but it's a sigh. And this story, Eddie Levert, when Eddie Levert comes, that's the story that felt like a sigh to me. So I had my bookends, and then I had, you know, a few rules in for ordering things in the middle. So it came together pretty well.
I love ending with a sigh and the sense of, like, you know, you hear people say, where do you start a story? Yeah. You start with like a character or a sentence or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I love when people say, as you just did, there's a feeling or an emotion that you want to evoke instead.
Yeah.
What, and I want to come back to Church Ladies and have you read for a second, but if you could tell me with the novel, do you have an emotion you're starting with or that you want to evoke? Is it a sigh novel or is it like a,
It'll be like a satisfied sigh because, you know, I want it to be satirical. So I do want people to laugh, but I want, but there's also some, you know, serious stuff. Because it's, you know, still around this idea of church and the boxes that church tries to, that church, you know, compels us to try and squeeze ourselves into that don't fit. And the shame and the fear and the guilt. So serious, heavy topics, but handled satirically. So I'm really inspired by Paul Beatty's The Sellout. And the way he opens that novel is fantastic. The main character is at the Supreme Court, the real Supreme Court. So he mentions, like, real justices by name. And he's, if memory serves, I think he might be under a table. But he's also smoking like a huge blunt in the Supreme Court. And then after that amazing opening, the rest of the story starts from the beginning. How did he get there? How did he end up at the Supreme Court? He's a black man accused of enslaving another black man. So not funny. Slavery's not funny. And yet this whole premise and how it's presented is actually hilarious. So I'm going to try to do something like that. So I got, again, opening with a bang and then, handling these kind of weighty topics, but in a way where there is some levity. And, satire is, you really are taking aim at something. Mm-hmm. So there's a sharpness there and there's a seriousness there. But as I took a workshop on satire and it was pointed out that if you don't have any love in your satire, it's just sneering, and mm-hmm. I'm not going to write a sneering novel. And so it's mocking something that you love. And so, that's sort of what's keeping me, those are kind of the parameters that I'm working with right now. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that sounds such like a wonderful novel. Seriously, I can't wait. And since we have a few minutes left, let's say, will you read us out today? And I'm going to see if I can highlight you. I've never done that before, so bear with me. Let's see. Nope, that highlighted me instead. Let's see if I can highlight you.
All right.
Nope, that's me again. Hold on. Let me see. This is why I need a producer. If anyone wants to come on and be a producer for me.
Writer, mother, monster, producer.
Yeah, exactly. To help me highlight the right person. I'm just going to put us back to.
That's fine. I'm good.
Yeah. There we go. Okay. Go ahead.
And you know what? I'm going to read the first two pages of Peach Cobbler.
Please do. Thank you.
My mother's peach cobbler was so good, it made God himself cheat on his wife. When I was 5, I hovered around my mother in the kitchen, watching, close enough to have memorized all the ingredients and steps by the time I was 6, but not too close to make her yell at me for being in the way, and not close enough to see the exact measurements she used. She never wrote the recipe down. Without having to be told, I learned not to ask questions about that cobbler or about God. I learned not to say anything at all about him hunching over our kitchen table every Monday, eating plate after plate of peach cobbler, and then disappearing into the bedroom I shared with my mother. I became a silent student of my mother and her cobbler making ways, even when I was older and no longer believed that God and Reverend Troy Neely were one and the same. I still longed to perfect the sweetness and textures of my mother's cobbler. My mother, who fed me TV dinners, baked a peach cobbler with fresh peaches every Monday, her day off from the diner where she waited tables. She always said Sunday was her Saturday and Monday was her Sunday. What I knew was that none of her days were for me. And for many of those Mondays off and on during my childhood, God, to my child's mind, would stop by and eat an entire 8x8 pan of cobbler. My mother never ate any of the cobbler herself. She said she didn't like peaches. She would shoo me out of the kitchen before God could offer me any, but I doubted he would have offered even if I'd sat right down next to him. God was an old fat man, like a black Santa, and I imagined my mother's peach cobbler contributing to his girth. Some Mondays, God would arrive after dinner and leave as I lay curled up on the couch watching Little House on the Prairie in the living room. Other times, my mother and God would already be in the bedroom when I got home from school. I could hear moaning and pounding like a board hitting a wall as soon as I entered the house. I would shut the front door quietly behind me and tiptoe down the hall to listen outside the bedroom door. Oh God, oh God, oh God, my mother would cry. I could hear God too, his voice low and growly saying, yes, yes, yes. Thank you.
Wow. I have to say that's one of my favorite stories in the collection too. People can see why. And amazing job reading it too. I love the performance. Thank you so much for joining me. This is such a pleasure.
This has been wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Now stick around after so I can say goodbye.
Okay.
But thank you again for joining us. And I really cannot wait for the next book we'll have you come back on.
I'd love that. Thank you.
And thank you all for joining us tonight, too. I hope you enjoyed Disha and the reading. And thank you for tuning in. You can watch the video, listen to the audio, or read the transcript on writermothermonster.com. If you enjoyed the conversation, consider becoming a patron or patroness to help keep this going. And join me on Saturday for the first Writer Mother Monster workshop, just in time for Mother's Day, prioritizing your craft for writer moms. Check it out on writermothermonster.com under the classes link. And thank you again. See you next week.